Welcome to Your Right to Speak, discussions on child and youth rights and advocacy. This is episode 2. I'm your host, Sammy D'Agostino. Today we'll be talking with Kim Snow, who is a professor at Ryerson University in the child and youth care degree. Kim, can you please introduce yourself?
Hi. So I'm Kim Snow. I'm a CYC, and I have been my entire career. I've worked in a variety of settings, I think all the different service settings, from youth criminal justice, child welfare, children's mental health. But my focus has been in children's mental health and what's called emancipatory youth practice.
So can you please explain what emancipatory youth practice is?
Well, I think the terms that you hear a lot that refer to it are youth engagement, but I think emancipatory youth practice is slightly more, I'd say, than youth engagement. Youth engagement is about including young people and having them participate, whereas emancipatory practices are about allowing young people to fulfill their own capacity and achieve their own advocacy, their own goals, their own control of their own life. And it is something that in my work in child welfare and in children's mental health I've found to be really important, because these are young people who are most marginalized and most excluded from their own voice, whether it's in youth criminal justice, kids work in living in group homes, or kids on the streets. Very often they have very little say in their own life. Emancipatory youth practice puts young people at the center of their own life.
Thank you for that clarification. Before we really dive into the questions, I was wondering if you can please explain for the listeners what a Crown Ward is.
Okay, a Crown Ward is a young person who the state, the government, and in Ontario that would be a judge, has decided that their parents cannot be their guardian and act as a person responsible for them. And the state assumes permanent care of that child. So essentially the state becomes the parent, and the Crown Ward is permanently removed from the care of their parents.
Thank you. So, in your opinion, would you feel that, or would you say that there is a stigma of, or a stigma associated with children and youth who are Crown Wards in the care system?
I think we know this. I think it's gone beyond just opinion. I think there's numerous studies, including some of my own studies, that show that young people in care are a stigmatized group. And you can look at this in a number of ways, whether we look at how young people talk about their experiences in care, and they'll talk about stigma, and what I call, actually Irving Goffman called, evidentness. Right? So how evident it is for people that you are in care. And young people in care describe a perpetual feeling of evidentness. The other thing is when we ask professionals and community members what their impression of kids in care are, and again, there's a stigma attached to that. An interesting thing I find is I've taught CYC for about 18 years, and I like to think my students are sensitized. Yet when I bring young people from care to speak to them, it is almost expected now that at least someone will put their hand up and ask the young person what they did to be brought into care. That's part of the problem. Young people, by definition, have not done anything to be brought into care. Somebody has done to them or something's happened to them, say a parent has died. That's the definition of becoming a Crown Ward. So that people still continue in today's time to ask, what did that young person do, suggests the misunderstanding we have about why young people are in care.
Right, and I think that's a really good example of some of the stigma that young people face. Could you give another example?
Very often, and I do a lot of work in the education system to sensitize around this, I'll very often hear young people talk about how teachers respond to kids in care. So, for example, I have one young person who will say that once a teacher finds out that a young person is in care, they'll either be afraid of them or feel sorry for them. And either are really unpleasant standpoints from a perspective of young people in care. The other is when it's disclosed to young people in care or young people in school, they don't understand what it means to be a foster child or a kid in a group home. And so there's a reaction by the peers that is alienating for the kids in class. So very often young people will go to school and hide their care status for fear of how they'll be judged if they disclose being a child in care.
Do you think that relates back to having like a sense of identity and what their identity looks like to them?
I heard it in belonging Right. I really believe belonging is an essential human need, and if we look at Maslow, I think belonging is a piece mm-hmm. that we need to include in there. And these are young people, by and large, who have already experienced ruptures. Regardless of what was going on in their home and their home community, they still had some sort of network around them that was familiar to them. Whatever happened to cause the state to intervene and take them to a place of safety, even if it was necessary, it means that they have lost a sense of their place, a sense of their known familiar environment. Without that, you feel discombobulated. When you go to a new job or you go to a new school, you kind of have to find your way around until you find a way to belong, whether that's finding a friend or a club or even where you sit in your desk, right? That's my desk. Belonging gives us a sense of rootedness. And when kids are pulled from these families and communities and placed elsewhere, it takes some time to adjust and to settle in and to have that sense of belonging. So I think the disruption that these young people face is part of it. When you layer stigma on and workers coming and going and school changes, many kids in care will move frequently, they'll have frequent school changes, all these impact on your sense of, I belong here. Mm-hmm. And we don't exactly, well, we have some new places, but we don't have a lot of places that say, you belong because you're a kid in care. And here, wear this shirt that proudly says, you're in care. Mm-hmm. Because we haven't known how to help young people have a sense of belonging in this different status than other kids.
So, since you brought up belonging, it was one of my later questions, but let's dive into that. In one of your published articles about, well, maybe before I ask that, could you explain what the Voyager Project is?
Okay. Voyager Project is a peer-led, peer-to-peer social networking group, okay, that focuses on young people achieving their educational goals. And education, from my perspective, could be anything from taking a course to learn how to use Microsoft Word to getting a trade, to getting a certificate, to a diploma, to a degree. It's the whole spectrum. And the Voyager Project works with having current and former Crown Wards reach out to other current and former Crown Wards and encouraging them to pursue their educational aspirations. This ties into the idea of belonging in that, you know, we know that young people in care have lower graduation rates and much, much lower post-secondary education participation rates. And I believe that that's at the root is a sense of belonging, a lack of belonging in school. So this sense of belonging, the disconnection from community happens at the level of school. And the Voyager Project is meant to help young people in care see that they do belong and that there is a place for them in post-secondary education. And it's rooted in following your dreams and following what interests you and pursuing those to build your own capacity. And through that process of capacity building, you'll network with other very cool Crown Wards who are doing wonderful things and create your own sense of belonging. You'll find your own pathway and your own place in this community that roots you in care, but also in the community.
That sounds like a great project. I think you touched upon it a bit before about this link between stigma and that sense of belonging. Can you maybe explain a bit more in detail of what that link is?
Well, I think young people talk most about unbelonging. Okay, we did a project for a whole year on belonging in the Voyager Project. We hired people to look at it. We did multimedia things. We did spoken word. We did art. We really looked at the issue of belonging, or so I thought. And as often happens in the Voyager Project, I have an idea, and then the young people make it, tell me what the reality is. And so I wanted to talk about belonging because I like to be hopeful, and I think that this is a really positive thing. And they looked at me like, we don't know how to describe that. What they could describe for me was not belonging. Okay? So we actually ended up spending an entire year talking about what it means not to belong, with the idea of coming around to what does it mean to belong. And the only route we had in was through unbelonging. And so some of the examples I've already said came up. We ended up spending a lot of time talking about what are all the indicators for young people in care that they don't belong. So we did a whole thing on young people in group homes, quote, going into the community. Okay? I don't know about you, but I don't go into the community when I go outside, right?
Yeah.
I don't have community outings. Mm-hmm. We don't take our family out to the community. But we do this in care without thinking about what that language says. Well, that language clearly says you don't belong, but occasionally we're going to let you come visit the community. Then you'll go back to your group home, and you'll come back. So some of it was unpacking all the ways that messages are given to young people, that they don't belong here, that they are different, that they are excluded. And so we unpacked language, we unpacked rules, so, you know, whether young people could have sleepovers, the challenges of getting jobs, all the things that say to young people, we have to protect the community from you. And child welfare people, rightfully so, will say to me, but no, we're protecting the children from the community. Well, I think we all do that with our kids. Mm-hmm. But we don't label it in the same way as we do in the professionalized care setting, right? And I think that some of the issues around not belonging that were raised for me with the young people have to do with us as CYCs and how we use language and how we have inadvertently created this language of exclusion. I also work with young people and talk about that young people in care are bilingual, right? And mm-hmm. What I mean by that is that they have young people language, but they also have to survive, become adept at our language, professional language. And that, in fact, if you want to know what's going on in any care setting, the people who are most advantaged are the young people, because by necessity, they must learn both languages. So they have to learn the language of the care system to survive, otherwise there are always going to be consequences. And they have to know the language of their peers, or they're not going to fit in. The staff actually don't bother to learn the language of the young people. They just know their own professional language. So who has the better perspective about what's going on? The fuller perspective is, of course, from the young people. Emancipatory practices, for example, would use that as leverage and help young people see that they are actually the ones who have the expertise, and the staff are disadvantaged in this situation. When young people grasp this, when they get that they actually have a more broad, more comprehensive understanding of what goes on, they are able then to direct things, their own care, in a different way.
So would you say, because to me I'm hearing that there's a lot of, we'll say, issues in the CYC field around like how we use language and how we work with children and youth. Mm-hmm. And would you say that like one way to combat that is in our training, is in the schools where we're learning to really be CYCs and to kind of broaden our understanding of what it really is to work with young people?
Yes. Yep. And I think we'd have to change our leadership style. So I subscribe to a type of leadership called servant leadership. Okay, so I believe I'm here to be of service, and I need to direct my work to the point of greatest need and to act of service. I'm not sure that is always consistent with how our field is trained. I think that, much like the rest of the world, we push for a leadership model that actually is self-interested. And so people build their own career and their own capacity without thinking about the impacts on others. One of the key ways that you'll see this is I spend a lot of time listening to how people talk. And when I hear people talk about I all the time, I do this, I've done this, I am the, I have the, I'm really worried about them in terms of care. Because care is a we. Care is that we do this, we did this, my young people, right? So you notice I often talk about my young people because these are my young people, right? But I'm also their kin, right? It goes both ways because we are a we together. So I think we have to help people in CYC understand that the real leadership comes from helping other people become strong and supporting their voice. And in fact, fading off into the background. I like to think in my Voyager project, for example, that really my job is paying the bills and cleaning up after. I should be pretty invisible in the middle, because this is about their work and their voice and their ability to move forward. So I think in the schools we must look at how we are viewing our role, and it's hard because CYCs, of course, want to professionalize, and that gives us a view of what that means. And mm-hmm. I think that sometimes makes us seek leaders and look at people who are very much focused on themselves rather than the we and the collective, right? That we have to see this as a profession of service, and that the duty is different. Still a profession. I have no problem. I've been a CYC for 30 years. I'm very proud of that. But I view my role as of being of service to others, not of myself. So we have to have our young CYCs coming up and understanding that there is real value in service, and it's a type of leadership that will bring you gains, right? We don't all have to replicate the psychiatrists and the social workers and the psychologists to get professional status. We can actually look in a different way, one that is more collective. But then we also have to realize that we're working in these multidisciplinary settings that have professionalized language, and we need to challenge some of that. I gave the example of community, but level and token economy systems, right? I've done this at times. I've given this as an assignment. You can go on the bus, and if you ride the bus long enough, you can identify the kids in care. Do you know how?
No, how?
Their language. Kids who are not in care don't talk about supervisors and workers and ministry approval and plans of care and outings and all these kinds of things, right? We have a language, and each setting has its own little uniqueness, but overall we have this jargon of the field that we teach young people. And then we're surprised when they look a bit out of sorts compared to other kids because their language is different. Most kids are not asking for ministry approval to go on a field trip. Most kids don't know what a program supervisor is. Most kids don't talk about clothing allowances. But we do, because these are the structures and the languages of our field. So, you know, we just got rid of extended care and maintenance, which I hated that term because, you know, I got an extended care and maintenance package on my car. Right? So why we were providing that. But continuing care is going to be the next kind of language, right? We have to really be able to look at, do we have the jargon that says you belong, you're cared for, that you're ours, right? And it's up to us. This is not the young people's job to figure this out for us. We have to come
Absolutely.
To terms with our language.
So besides, I guess, like, our education, do you find that some of the policies is another way that we can change our language?
Sure, but we don't also have to adopt the language of the policies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really, you know, maybe it's just cynical, and I have an enormous faith in CYCs. I think we can solve this. We're at the front line. We're with the young people. We have the unique perspective. The fundamental difference is we're the only one who's looking at the child in their family, their community, and context. So we have a different perspective. And if we really embrace that perspective, then we're not going to just be buying the language that's given to us from some ministry bureaucrat who isn't looking from the perspective of the child, right? They may be looking from the perspective of the family or the community or the government, but their starting point isn't the child. So, yes, policy, changing policy could help, but, you know, at this stage in my career, I realize that the bureaucrats at Queen's Park are going to make policy that's very bureaucratic.
Mm-hmm.
It's up to us what we do with it.
And how we work with it. And
mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's very interesting. You know, I knew language was an issue, but not really to the extent that you've explained it. So I've had a couple of epiphanies that I thank you for. We just need to wrap up.
Sure.
But I do have one more question that I ask all my guests, because
mm-hmm.
I find it's a very individual perspective. What does advocacy mean to you?
Okay. Well, several things. Okay, so if I think about systemic, broader advocacy, that really is how I view myself as a servant leader. I will put my capacities, whatever those are, to the cause, so to speak, that I think is showing the greatest injustice. So for me, you know, in the last number of years, that's been working on reserve, working with Crown Wards in education, because I see the gap, I see the injustice, and I have an obligation. It's not even a choice. I feel obligated to speak out or to lend my voice or even just stand beside sometimes. So that's the systemic. In terms of individual case advocacy, really I think it's much more about helping young people assert their voice, reach their capacity, and then maybe when needed, loan my authority or perceived authority or power to them. I have to tell you, I hate the word empowerment. A lot of people are surprised by that, because I have no ability to give my power to you as much as maybe I want to. And I really have very, very little ability to give you any power. But I have some power, you have some power, right? I have different types of power, and some of it's just ascribed power, some of it's, you know, status and age, and lots of things that our society gives power to people. But none of it can I share or distribute. No matter how much I like that idea, I can't do it. For me, it's about recognizing that and helping young people find their own power, find their own voice, and then being aware of the times where the power that is for whatever reason ascribed to me, I can loan that by standing beside them, sitting beside them, maybe making a phone call, maybe going, hang on, did you really get hurt there? Let's talk that through. But I think sometimes we make a mistake that advocacy is about speaking for. It's not. There are times where you do need to speak for. There are vulnerable people. There are young people in our care system who have no voice. But all of them have something to say. And then our job is to help understand that and then loan our voice to them, right? Not take over it. And that takes some time and experience to learn. But when you do that, you're actually building people's capacity. And then what you see, and I see this 30 years later, I mean, there's some amazing advocates out there because I had some faith in their voice. And they become so much stronger than I ever could be. And that's where advocacy changes the world.
You know, that reminds me so much of, and I believe it's Gartfax characteristics of you working with and being there for, and that definition of advocacy resonates with me so much in those characteristics, and I find that it's unique for the CYC perspective. It's not working for, it's working with. We're with the, you know, the young person, we're meeting them where they're at. So before we end off our lovely conversation, and I wish we had more time, do you have anything else that you feel that you need to say? Or
I think that working with young people, acting in service, is not only a very rewarding career, it is essential to doing the kind of work that we do in CYC. You know, I often tell my students that I've never had anybody sent to me to be in my care that didn't have a problem. So there's no point pretending otherwise. Young people come to me for a reason. Our job is to help them figure out the world and navigate the world so it's not a problem for them anymore. And when you do that, that's what's transformative. That's where change happens.
Well, thank you very much, Kim, for your time today. I really do appreciate it. Your right to speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. Once again, thank you, Kim. If you would like to be on the show, or if you have a topic that you think we should be talking about, or if you're a child or youth that will, you know, like to be on the show and express yourself, please email me at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. That's yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast.
Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher.
Visit us online at cycpodcast.org.